Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. I'm very happy to have as my guest Colm Toibin. His new novel is called House of Names, and it's a novel that is based on Greek tragedy, in particular the tragedies of the House of Atreus. And we begin with the story of a would-be wedding and a murder. Clytemnestra is told that her daughter is to be wed if she will only bring her daughter, Iphigenia, in her beautiful wedding garb to the battlefield. There will be a wedding on the battlefield for the success of the troops. She does bring Iphigenia, but instead it's her husband Agamemnon's intention to sacrifice Iphigenia to the gods so that the winds will blow them in the right way. Here we have a mother dressed for her daughter's wedding, a daughter expecting to be married, and instead we encounter sacrifice of a very intense sort, and the shock of it is very extreme. Now, Colm, tell me, these are emotions that are way beyond the normal bounds. How did you find a way to give a voice immediately to these extremes?
I didn't know Euripides' late play Iphigenia in Aulis. I simply hadn't read it. And once I read it, it came to me that I had seen the story always from Electra's side, from the daughter's side. I had not seen
the
it.
The living daughter, the daughter who was not killed.
Yeah, the daughter who was not killed, who later blames her mother, etc. But that I had not seen it from Clytemnestra's point of view. And once then I began, all I needed really was an opening few sentences, which came to me very quickly. You know, I just wrote down the few sentences the book opens with. And then all I needed to do was to tell that story using that same tone. It was almost like getting a melody. And once the melody came, then I had the rest of the story. The problem then was what to do after that.
Let's hear the first paragraph, the paragraph that gave birth to the tone.
I have been acquainted with the smell of death, the sickly, sugary smell that wafted in the wind towards the rooms in this palace. It is easy for me now to feel peaceful and content. I spend my morning looking at the sky and the changing light. The bird song begins to rise as the world fills with its own pleasure. And then, as day wanes, the sound too wanes and fades. I watch as the shadows lengthen. So much has slipped away, but the smell of death lingers.
Colm Toibin, the first paragraph of House of Names. Now tell me, the phrase House of Names occurs in the book, but what does House of Names, where does that come from?
The figure of Orestes, when I went to say, well, is there a play that tells us where Orestes was before he returns? He famously returns in the Oresteia. His sister Electra is waiting for him. He has been away. She wants to murder her mother, Clytemnestra, in retaliation for Clytemnestra's murder of Agamemnon, which is in retaliation, etc. But where was he? So I presume there would be some source for that somewhere. But when I found there wasn't, I was almost delighted because I realized I can now work with this, that I can give him all these scenes that really have no source at all in the Greek, and that I can start imagining him being taken away when his mother is going to murder his father. And I can see the journey where he was taken. And then he, and two friends. He is kidnapped, and then he and two friends escape. And they escape across a landscape until they come to the very end of the world, it seems. And they move into a realm which is almost a fenced-off realm, a dream world that has been protected formally by dogs, with sea on three sides, perhaps, you know, and cliffs all round. This is where the old woman lives. And this is where then they can spend some years where they're almost protected from the outside world. From he's, for example, Orestes does not know that his mother killed his father, but that knowledge doesn't bother him over these years because he has his two friends with him. The old woman looks after them. But they realize slowly that the house they're in did have other people in it. And she says, well, some of the men went to war and the others fled, but she was too frail to be taken. So they simply left her behind. And then she says, you know, this was a house of names. And what I'm using there is John Millington Synge's Riders to the Sea, where the old woman at the end of the play begins to list out the names of her sons who were all killed, who were all drowned as fishermen. So it's that idea that in these rooms there were many, many people who had names, and it was a house of names. But then the word names keeps coming up, people not being able to remember names. But also then crucial names, Orestes, Clytemnestra, Electra, Agamemnon, and Iphigenia.
Now, it is quite natural that a book reinventing the Greek tragedy should also make reference to Irish myth and mythology, but fairy tale, myth, tragedy, all of these, it seems as if you are interrogating the roots of narrative.
Yeah, I think interrogation is too strong a word. What I'm doing is I'm simply using it. I'm simply, any time I needed something as I was working, I there must be something somewhere. For example, there's a moment where a number of the guards are killed, and the men who killed them then are killed in turn, and their faces are badged with blood, which is straight from Macbeth.
I was thinking,
and
yes.
And then the woman is in possession, the old woman is in possession of various stories, which includes the story of Helen of Troy, but also includes the Irish folk tale, the children of Lir, the children who were turned into swans. So that any time I needed anything, I simply reached down into my memory and picked up whatever was at hand from Shakespeare, from Irish mythology, from folk tale, from anywhere I wanted it, including from the various Greek sources. So, and other times then, I was fine. I could work entirely from imagination.
Well, one of the huge surprises in House of Names by my guest, Colm Toibin, is I had always thought about Prince Orestes' relation to his father, Agamemnon, but I had never before bisociated it with Prince Hamlet's relation to his murdered father.
And neither had I, no. And it was only when I was working, when I have him return, and then he's in the palace, his father has been murdered, his mother has taken a lover, and he is very uneasily wandering the corridors. And of course it struck me, that story remains the great story, you know, that Shakespeare took for Hamlet. And what you can do then is you can work with the consciousness of the young man. The consciousness of the young man is so, on one hand, haunted, and on the other hand, so uneasy and uncertain that he will, under certain circumstances, do anything at all. He will put an antic disposition on. You know, he will warn his mother, or indeed he will murder his mother. But if you then add a sister, Electra, as an ingredient, you then get further pressure on him where sometimes he's almost blank, he's almost nobody. And anyone can lead him anywhere. He has no strategy. And everyone else in the book is sometimes their only strategy. They all are weaving webs all the time, each of them. And poor Orestes is not weaving a web. So he's Hamlet without the education or the great intelligence. He's blanker than Hamlet.
He seems, at least to me, when I encountered him, his is the voice of the second section of the book. And he's like a toddler. He will follow anyone who will play with him.
And he never grows up.
He's like a thumbsucker in a certain
way. Yes, exactly, yes.
And I found him so moving, so endearingly moving, because there is so much pressure on him to avenge and revenge and retaliate. It's almost as if he offers a different possibility to the narrative of endless retaliation, which is the narrative of introspection.
You see, the novel won't hold heroism easily. And so if you say Orestes came back and he was a hero and he knew what to do, well, that's not a novel. That's a different sort of story. And once you introduce levels of uncertainty, you realize the more uncertain he is, the more you can get from him. He's not a psychopath. He's not autistic. He's not on a spectrum. None of those words will work for him. But he will, under certain circumstances, do anything. And because I have to build up, really from page one, the idea that this is a young man who will eventually murder his own mother. I want you to believe it and follow him and see him afterwards as well. And so that I need, the first thing I need is that when his sister is being sacrificed, and again, I have no source for this, he's meant to be playing, he's been taken away, but he hears all the noises and he comes and he actually watches. And he's alone watching his sister being sacrificed, having her throat cut. But he's not in any way evil or heroic or in any way active. He's entirely passive, strange, good-willed, seeing what he can do.
Yes, what's eerie about this book, House of Names, is in the first chapter we see a father essentially murder his daughter. And the book repeatedly goes through acts of amnesia so that we will soon see a son plotting to murder his father. When we meet the ghosts of these dead people, Electra learns by experimentation that the ghosts don't remember their deaths, that death is itself part of the story of life, and that ghosts don't participate in that story. That's such a brilliant and odd perception. Where, how did you come on it?
I have absolutely no idea, but it is again working with Hamlet's father's ghost, but taking out the motive.
Yes.
It's constantly that business of erasure, where imagine if he just appears, the ghost of Hamlet's father, but he doesn't know that how he has been killed. So he just comes back into the world seeking something else, one more thing. He wants something, but he doesn't know what it's called. And that makes it much more mysterious and strange than if they just come seeking revenge or wanting the moment of their death to be described. In other words, I wanted something that was more poetic than plot-led.
Well, I found it to be, Colm, like reading a ghost novel. I mean, it really thrilled me. It's as if the reader is with the writer as he filches from the poisoned wells of the unconscious motives for impossible acts. And watching this made it an unforgettable act of reading. I know that we're talking about Greek myths and sources and where it came from, but I have to say that I'd rather talk about it as a galvanizing book that kept this reader up very late in the magic, really, the terror of things that happen in narrative that happen in life. This book, House of Names, is a magic story of the brutal revenges and retaliations that we're living among today. This is a very contemporary novel, and what makes it exciting is that we're understanding the present through the guise of the past and its lore.
I suppose it's, for me, it's a personal book as much as a political book. And so it's not a game where I'm retelling these myths because I had nothing else to do that year. You know, I mean, I know that you could do that. But it is as though there were certain things here, especially the idea of the dead and the dead coming back and of people within families being hugely isolated and uncertain of themselves. This book was written during the Syrian Civil War. But I come from a country where we've had two civil wars in the 20th century, and one of which my family was involved in, and the other which I worked on as a reporter. So these violent things are close to me, and they matter to me. But then underneath them, or perhaps above them, or haunting them, are other more personal things to do with family dynamics and with the role of the dead in the lives of the living.
There's a scene, for instance, where Electra, who is less pretty than her sister Iphigenia, she arranges with the seamstresses to make clothing for her, like Iphigenia's clothing. And she comes into the room to witness the quintessential family response to a daughter's independent decision. The mother, Clytemnestra, says, "Why are you wearing that? Just this, will you go and seat her at a table where no one will notice her, please?" And it's so frightening to see the family dynamic so pedestrian at play in counterpoint to the heroism of the tragedy.
Yes, each of them has a weakness. Agamemnon's weakness, he is not heroic, is that he knows what he should do, which is not sacrifice his daughter. And then he knows what he will do, which is he will sacrifice her. And you watch him wavering, and you watch his wife's contempt for him. Clytemnestra's weakness is Phrygistus. When she sees this beautiful man who she can have in her bed, she takes him too much into her confidence. And in fact, that causes a great deal of trouble for her. But there's also this, a sense of sexual jealousy going on between her and her daughter Electra. It isn't merely that Electra's objection to her mother is that she killed her father without permission from the gods. It is between the two women. There is almost a battle going on for who is the sexual presence, the sexual female presence in the palace. And when the daughter tries to assert herself sexually, the mother knows exactly what to do, which is to put her in the corner in the shadows where no one will see her and laugh at her.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Colm Toybean about his new novel, House of Names. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Colm Toybean about his latest book, House of Names, a tale that reveals a classic vilified character, Clytemnestra, for what she really is, a fierce woman avenging the life of her child. Here we are, then, in a family drama that bears all sorts of intensified similarities to some of the dramas in your previous books.
I suppose I only have one story to tell, which is my own. And my job is to constantly see if there's a way of attempting to disguise that, or to find ways around it, or to find metaphors that are far enough away from it that I can sort of forget about myself, but it keeps coming back to certain things. The dead father, the powerful mother, the boys caught between various forces, the idea of being sent away, homecoming, exile, homosexuality. But I needed another shape for it this time. And I was desperately hoping, in a way, that I could keep away from what I care about most. But you never can. The bringing back the dead part, I mean, the allowing the mother to emerge. I mean, he has murdered his mother. And you turn the page, and there she is as a ghost. And in a way, what I wrote that section in about 2 days. There's hardly any revision in it. And with the rest of the book, there was quite a lot of addition because it was plot-led. So I'm adding little bits of plot, little bits of who knew what and did they know and other things that occurred. With that, it's voice. It's just simply someone's voice moving, that she's appeared back into the world, and what she's looking for is her son. So what she's looking for, in a way, is me. And I'm working. I don't even know I'm working because I'm just simply writing this down. I don't even know where it's going to go in the book. It's unexpected, and once it's done, I realize that it, and it's only a few pages, that I probably haven't written anything as true or as sort of that I'm generally as happy with as those few pages, that I've obviously been waiting to write them since my mother died, and here they come. And I found a myth that would govern them. I found a way that I could get permission to do this, a story I could tell where I could use these particular phrases, these particular desires and images.
The reader has to penetrate into these darker, more ghostly regions where the story really is transacting from unconscious desire, from sexual hunger, from a constant feeling of loss.
In the Oresti, what happens is the Furies pursue him. Now, I'm going for a big, long walk thinking, how am I going to put the Furies into a contemporary novel? And what I want to do is exactly the opposite, that the Furies will come as silence. People just don't want Orestes in the room. And they don't want to talk to him, and they go silent when he appears. And that is my version of the Furies. The Furies come as no noise, as no fury, as a sort of nullness, a sort of nullity. And that really punishes him because all he wants is Leander to be back with him as his friend, as his lover, his sister Electra back as a part of the family. He wants everybody back. No, they will never come back to him. He will always be the one left alone. And he doesn't even understand this, so it has to be explained to him. And that is my version of the Furies.
I want to close this show with the sound of the book itself. This happens to be in, I believe, a Clytemnestra section.
This is her ghost, and she's seeking her son, not remembering that her son is the one who has murdered her. I was waiting, knowing that there would be change, that it would not always be like this. I was aware how easy it would be, once I was in those corridors again, for one of the guards to notice me if I made a sound or if I moved quickly, so that there would be some disturbance in the air. And then slowly I began to understand why I was here and who I was looking for. His name did not come to me, and I was not able to picture his face, but I felt that he was close. I could imagine the guard who had seen me or who had noticed my presence consulting one of the other guards, and then both of them approaching him, the one I am searching for, or his friend who looks after him. My husband is dead, and my daughter, they have become pure shade. My other daughter is here, but the one I am searching for is my son. I am awake, the words I knew are sleeping. Sometimes they turn in the night or make some sound in their vast dreaming, and then they wake too. Often, if only for a second, they open their eyes and watch me. I hold their gaze so that they might remember me as they fall back into sleep. I study them then in their inert state. I'm alert to any movement they make. I can hear their dark groanings in the night, intermittent against their breathing. I can see them reach their arms towards me to be lifted. I can tell the difference between night and day now. I know the silence that descends on the gardens and the corridors at night, a silence broken only by the soft movements of the guards or of cats. This is my realm, where I'm free to wander. As I come from the garden, I'm aware that the guards can feel a movement in the air. It would just take one more thing to let them know that I'm with them, a sound, a darting gesture. When the time came, I knew that I would hear his name, my son's name, enough to whisper it like someone imploring. It would come to me when I needed it. Orestes, I whispered on one of those nights, and then I withdrew into the shadows. Orestes, I repeated, letting my voice echo down the corridor. I saw two of the guards running back and forth and then summoning the other one, my son's friend, who strutted up and down, checking doorways and corners. I waited until he had gone, and then I whispered to one of the guards, "Tell Orestes that I am his mother. He must come alone into the corridor. He must be alone." The guard made as though to run, but then stopped himself. "Speak again," he said quietly, his head bowed. "Tell Orestes to come alone," I said. "Now?" he asked. "Soon. Orestes must come soon." "Do you mean to cause him harm?" "No, I do not mean to cause him harm."
I've been talking with Colm Toybean, author of House of Names, published by Scribner. I hope you could hear in this interview that this is a book whose intensities overflow their pages. I found it to be an utterly intriguing book. I couldn't stop reading it, and then, because it had accomplished so much in such a reasonable space, I read it again. Thank you, Colm, for joining
me. Thank you very much, Michael. Thank you.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from House of Names at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she's a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Ian is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.